Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the crisis in American foreign policy, with our Secretary of State calling the President a effing moron, and the Republican Chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee warning that Rex Tillerson, General Mattis, and General Kelly are the, quote, people who help separate our country from chaos. David Rothkopf, a senior fellow at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a columnist at the Washington Post and the former editor and publisher of the Foreign Policy magazine, joins us to discuss reports that Trump's top cabinet secretaries have formed a suicide pact in which if one is suddenly fired by an unstable and impetuous president, the others will walk out of the White House, and how Trump has undercut Tillerson publicly to the point where he has no credibility abroad. We'll also look into the consequences of Trump's intention to pull out of the Iran deal next week, which will sow further chaos in U.S. foreign policy and lead to more isolation and self-marginalization of the United States on the world stage. Then we are joined in the studio by Dr. Lance Dodis, who was a clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and is a contributor along with 26 other psychiatrists and mental health experts who have contributed to a new book assessing President Trump, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. We'll examine the consequences that Trump is dangerously mentally ill and that he presents a clear and present danger to the United States and the world as long as he has access to the nuclear codes, allowing him to start a nuclear war because of a childish tantrum or some other trigger that could unhinge Trump's frail psyche. Then finally, we will look into the signals by the Republican Congress and the NRA that they will head off any serious moves on calling for gun control following the worst mass shooting in U.S. history by banning so-called bump stocks on semi-automatic assault rifles that allow the weapon to fire bullets at a rate similar to fully automatic machine guns. An expert on the Second Amendment and the history of gun control, Saul Cornell, chair of American history at Fordham University, joins us to discuss whether any real reform will happen after the Las Vegas massacre. And joining us now is David Rothkopf, a senior fellow at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a columnist for The Washington Post. He's been a longtime contributor to Foreign Policy magazine and was CEO and editor of the FP Group from 2012 to 2017. And his latest book is The Great Questions of Tomorrow. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Rothkopf.
Good to be back.
Well, thank you, David. And it's an extraordinary moment to have the Secretary of State, or have it revealed that the Secretary of State at a high-level meeting in the tank, the secure room in the Pentagon, totally frustrated with Donald Trump's intransigence over the nuclear deal with Iran, which, of course, Obama did. And Trump has this pathology that makes it compulsive on his part to want to undo everything that Obama did. And apparently in frustration, the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, said to a number of senior officials in the tank that Trump is an effing moron. And apparently NBC News is sticking by that in spite of Trump's claim that it's fake news, because they have a number of sources who have verified that this happened. And on top of that, of course, we have the Republican chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee saying that Rex Tillerson, General Mattis, and General Kelly are, quote, the people who help separate our country from chaos. I mean, this is not just a warning bell. This is like a 10-alarm fire going off, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, it's one of the most striking things about it is the degree to which we accept it as though this were normal or not something to be alarmed by. The President of the United States is not just being called a moron by some critic. He's being called a moron by the senior member of his cabinet. And honestly, anybody who's in Washington, D.C., who deals with cabinet officials or sub-cabinet officials knows that this is not an outlying view. This is the prevailing view. In fact, you might have a discussion about whether the president is intellectually competent to be the president, or you might have a discussion about whether he's emotionally competent to be president. And there's plenty of discussions, as was implied in the statement by Bob Corker that you just referred to. There's plenty of discussions that the president is emotionally unstable, is emotionally unfit to be the president of the United States. And we see it every day. We see it every time he tweets. A reporter gets under his skin. He attacks them. He attacks the First Amendment. A victim of a hurricane gets under his skin. He attacks her. He attacks the victims. He, you know, the head of North Korea gets under his skin. He threatens to destroy the country. Now, you know, words are words, but when you see a pattern like this, you have to worry. You have to say there is something underlying this that is disturbing, and that honestly does have its finger on the controls of America's nuclear arsenal.
Well, that's, I think, ultimately what we should all be focusing on. And there is a mechanism, the 25th Amendment. I'm not sure that the Vice President of the Cabinet would necessarily want to implement it. But do you think that if there was enough of a groundswell and a demand on the part of American citizens, whether they're Republicans and Democrats, because there's no impediment between the nuclear button and Donald Trump's mental state, and that's just the way the system is. So if he wakes up on the wrong side of the bed one day and wants to have a nuclear war, there's nothing to stop him.
There isn't. And, you know, when you talk about Mike Pence and you talk about some of the members of his cabinet, we've seen those cabinet meetings. We've seen them on television. He likes televising these things in much the same way that Kim Jong-un likes televising these things, or potentates in other countries like to, where he sits at a table and one by one he goes around the room and everybody says something flattering to him. Or Mike Pence gets on television and says Trump is a brilliant strategist, or Steve Mnuchin gets on television and says the same thing. He has surrounded himself by sycophants who will not challenge him. And if you have sycophants surrounding you, won't challenge you, the 25th Amendment's a moot discussion because it requires half of the cabinet to, you know, come to the conclusion that the president is unfit for office. But having said that, you know, sometimes we've just got to stop and set aside the politics, turn off the cable news, and say to ourselves, based on what we know as human beings, is this man fit? He's not. And that's very, very dangerous. And everybody has a responsibility to do what they can to rein that in whatever way they can, whether it's changing the nature of the Congress, raising the issue in local forums, raising it with their own political leaders. But the one thing we can't and mustn't do is to normalize this. To say, well, this is just the way it is. There's nothing we can do about it. We've got this quirky guy for the next 3.5 years, because the damage he's going to do in that period of time is incalculable.
But isn't that the problem, in a sense, that Donald Trump has finally landed the ultimate starring role in his own reality TV show, the highest rated TV show, the must-see TV on the global stage as President of the United States? He's not going to give that up, is he?
Well, I think that he's not going to give it up so long as he sees food for his ego in it. He's a narcissist, and he seeks to be satisfied in only one way, and that is flattery, things that he perceives as elevating to him. But there is a possibility, of course, that that's not what this job is going to provide him. And I think while he may decry things as fake news, you can look at the past week, and what have you seen? You've seen a ProPublica story about how Ivanka Trump and Donald Trump Jr. came very, very close to being indicted for fraud. And then at the last minute, the Manhattan DA was paid off by one of Trump's lawyers with a campaign donation, and he dropped the case over the recommendations of his staff. We've seen a situation where, apropos of the Iran deal that you talked about, the Secretary of Defense sat in front of the Congress this week and said, "I think this deal is good. I don't think we should back away from the deal." And so defiance from within there. He you know, seen the Puerto Rico thing blow up in his face. And he may be saying, oh, it's going great, but he knows it's not going great. And it's going to linger out there. Special counsel Robert Mueller is out there, and he is pursuing multiple cases where he's hired people to look into whether the president can preemptively pardon his people, and how do you stop that? How do you look into the financial crimes that are going on? There was a story that broke this week about Paul Manafort, the chairman of the president's campaign, who took the job of campaign chairman for nothing, apparently so that he would be in a position to curry favor with a Russian oligarch who sits at the right hand of Vladimir Putin. Every single day, the noose around Donald Trump tightens. And the real question is, what happens when he thinks that the job is actually damaging to him, that his freedom may be in jeopardy, that his reputation will be in tatters, that his kids may go to jail, that his kids may have to be fired, that, and so on and so forth. And I think when the scale tips in that regard, then it's not the scenario you described, and this may well be a guy who decides it's in his interest to declare victory and walk away.
But in the meantime, of course, he will do more damage. Next week, he'll be apparently decertifying the international nuclear deal with Iran, saying it's not in the national interest of the United States. He's going to kick it back to the Congress. Surely that's going to create total chaos in the international foreign policy arena, isn't it? And further isolate and self-marginalize the United States on the world stage?
Well, first of all, it's very clear it's going to isolate the United States because every other party to that deal thinks the deal is doing fine. Furthermore, the President's Secretary of Defense said the deal is going okay. We know that the Secretary of State probably thinks the deal is going okay. So the President is isolating the United States. He's also isolating himself. But I think that, you know, there are consequences of this that are more disturbing. Take decertifying Iran for no reason for this deal, and combine that with the President's statement about Rex Tillerson last weekend, in which he said, Rex is wasting his time negotiating with the North Koreans. We have other means of dealing with them. Essentially, what he's saying is, we don't believe in negotiations, and when we do deals, you can't take our word for it because we're willing to turn around on it. What does that leave? All that leaves is military action. And what it does is it takes a guy like Kim Jong-un, long viewed as one of the world's craziest and most awful leaders, and it puts him almost in the right if he acts in self-defense. I mean, Donald Trump is the biggest gift that Kim Jong-un has ever received, because he comes very close to making this hideous figure seem like he's the more rational, reasonable actor.
Right, and he gives attention to a pathetic regime operating on the premise of the tyranny of the weak. It gives them attention, which is what they crave. I think in a more serious way, though, he has been the biggest gift to China, a rising power, by self-marginalizing the United States, by getting out of the TPP as his first act. I mean, I think the canary in the coal mine here will be what happens with Australia, America's closest ally. I think there's some serious talk going on in Australia about its commitment to its longest and closest ally in terms of, you know, its trade with China versus whether the United States is a reliable partner anymore.
Every day, every hour of every day, every minute of every hour of every day that Donald Trump has been president, the United States' influence in the world has declined because he's a liar, because he doesn't honor our deals, because he has insulted our allies, because he has cuddled up to our enemies, because he has proven to be erratic, because he has created gridlock in a already dysfunctional U.S. system and has achieved nothing as president of the United States, because he is corrupt and is sending a message to foreign dictators and corrupt governments everywhere, that the United States will no longer be the conscience of the world, that the United States will no longer fight for democracy, that the United States will no longer stand up for certain values. And he supports the Erdogans of the world as they crush the press, and the Putins of the world as they crush the press and democracy. And the result of all of this is we get weaker every moment he's in power. And there's no sign of this turning while he is president of the United States, or frankly, while anybody who's in his close inner circle is in a position of influence. Now, I think Australia and other countries are saying, well, this can't go on forever. You know, the United States will snap back. But I'm not sure whether the U.S. will snap back, because if China steps in and other countries step in and say, no, we're going to lead, we're going to change institutional structures, we're going to play a different role, the United States is no longer reliable, when will you get another Trump? You need a different system. And the old system, by the way, is kind of antiquated and needs an upgrade. I think we could have, by the time Trump leaves office, if he leaves in 3.5 years, or if he leaves, God forbid, in 7 years, you could have a new world order in which the position of the United States is greatly diminished.
Let's turn, as depressing as it all is, there's even more to talk about, I'm afraid. David Rothkopf reports that Trump's top cabinet secretaries have formed a suicide pact in which if one suddenly is fired by this unstable and impetuous president, the others will walk out of the White House. Now, if Tillerson walks, of course, we'll end up with Nikki Haley, who is just as ignorant as Trump is when it comes to foreign policy. And of course, if Trump eventually leaves, we'll end up with Mike Pence, who next week, October the 12th in Manhattan, will be the keynote speaker at the Koch Brothers Network, their latest conclave. So a lot of people have suggested, perhaps cynically, that as chaotic and horrible as Trump is, and this, the having the finger on the nuclear button, he's not getting stuff done, whereas a more competent and just as dangerous person in many ways, Mike Pence, will be more effective.
Well, first of all, he is getting stuff done. He's damaging the United States. He's empowering our enemies. He's doing all the things we talked about. So Donald Trump there is not neutral, right? He's a corrosive figure. Nikki Haley is a terrible choice. John Bolton, who has also been brooded about as a potential Secretary of State, is an even worse choice. Bellicose, irrational, possibly one of the least distinguished, least credible in foreign policy circles, major figure that the national security system has produced in a long time. Pence is no bargain. He does have some experience with the government. He does have, you know, whether it's running the state or in the Congress. But unlike Trump, he actually has an ideology, and his ideology is a dangerous ideology that will damage the lives of countless Americans who choose a lifestyle that he doesn't embrace, or who happen to be women, or happen to be poor, or happen not to be white. None of these are terribly attractive options, but I would caution us to sort of jump to conclusions. It's also possible that, you know, now it's October 2017, that in the course of the next 12, 13 months, that Robert Mueller and a number of other people come up with things that are very damaging to Trump, that the leaks from within the administration about things like the suicide pact grow, and that this damages the Republican Party, as it should, and they lose the Congress in 2018. Well, the scenarios you talked about are very different if there's a democratically controlled Congress, because anybody who would step into Trump's place would be truly constrained. And indeed, if Trump were still in place and there were democratically controlled House of Representatives, the likelihood that he would subsequently be impeached goes up very dramatically.
Well, just in closing, let's touch on the Mueller investigation. This week, the chairs and co-chair of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee did a briefing. They said that the issue of collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians was still open. My understanding is that one aspect that Mueller is focusing in on is the possible collusion between the Russians and the data collection that went on through Cambridge Analytica, Mercer's company, of which Steve Bannon's on the board. They did Brexit They did the Republican campaign that elected Trump, with the help, obviously, of the Russians, and also the recent election in Kenya that's now being contested and has been overturned by the Supreme Court in Kenya. So I understand that could be the real smoking gun. In other words, the data mining in social media that was critical to Trump's victory, particularly in those key swing states, was apparently amplified, if you will, by Russian trolls and troll farms and bots. And if that connection is made, what happens? Do the American people realize that they should have a do-over? I mean, I can't see any other way that with all of the other things that happened, with the head of the FBI weighing in at the last minute, etc., the Russians, you name it, there's a whole bunch of factors here. But at the end of the day, don't they all add up to the idea that we don't have a legitimate president?
Well, I think they do add up to the idea that we don't have a legitimate president. I don't think we have a legitimate president. I think that there's enough things that happened that suggest that that's the case. But by the way, I don't think that George W. Bush was a legitimate president either. He lost the election, and it was a politically stacked Supreme Court decision that ended up taking the presidency from Al Gore and giving it to George W. Bush. Our system is broken. It's very important that we stop and recognize the system is broken. Having said that, I don't think that anything Miller is going to produce is going to lead us to have a do-over, except that we're going to have an election in 2020, and we've got a midterm election in 2018. But I would say a couple of things. One, the scenario you described is right, and by the way, the person who was responsible for this targeting within the campaign was Jared Kushner. And I think that, we'll get into, semantics of what is collusion and what is not collusion, but I think we're going to find that the communication between the Russians and the Trump campaign was much more than we even know now, and that whether there was collusion, cooperation, or acting in parallel with a common interest, that we should feel very uncomfortable with this. Leads me to second point, which is the Russians are still out there. They're still doing this. And the Trump administration has not done what is necessary to secure the system for the next round of elections or the next one, because I think, frankly, they like having the Russian thumb on the scale. And so I think we really need to focus also on what could happen in future elections. Finally, I would say, whether there's collusion or there's no collusion, the president of the United States is enriching himself off of the office. His family is enriching themselves off of the office. His daughter and her husband have abused the privilege of their security clearances multiple times in a way that's outrageous, given the attacks that were made on Hillary Clinton about her own emails by abusing their email system. The president, I think, in a number of instances, has influenced policy to serve the interests of his business. Every single day something new comes up. When the wheels lifted off of Puerto Rico, at that moment, the governor said, oh, by the way, the death toll is twice what we thought it was. Now, why didn't he say it before? And who told him? And who said to in the White House? And, why is it that Puerto Rico didn't get waivers that were going to other places? What's Donald Trump's interest there? And so I just think there are an endless number of cases to be made against Donald Trump. I think they will be made and evolve in multiple ways. And ultimately, I think they will bring him down. The question is, how do we protect ourselves against another Trump? How do we protect ourselves against the successors to Trump? And how do we protect ourselves against the abettors of Trump, like the Russians? We need to be looking forward, and we need to be taking those things very seriously, because as you said at the very outset, this is a moment that is fraught with peril for the American system of government and for America's role in the world, not to mention for the lives and well-being of millions of Americans.
Well, David Rothkopf, you've given us a lot to think about and a lot of future discussions, if that's okay with you. And I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And again, Amy, speaking with David Rothkopf, who's a senior fellow at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a columnist at the Washington Post. He's been a longtime contributor to Foreign Policy magazine and was CEO and editor of the Foreign Policy Group from 2012 to 2017. And his latest book is The Great Questions of Tomorrow. We can take a brief station break. We're back, joined in the studio by a former clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, who's a contributor to a new book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump.
And our ideas have no water, but we use them like a dam.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now in the studio is Dr. Lance Dodis, who's a training and supervising analyst emeritus with the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute, who was a clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. He is the author of The Heart of Addiction, Breaking Addiction, a 7-Step Handbook for Ending Any Addiction, and The Sober Truth. And Dr. Dodis is a contributor, along with 26 other psychiatrists and mental health experts who have contributed to the new book, Assessing President Trump, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Lance Dodis.
Thank you.
And what's the origin of this book? Because my understanding is that after the 1964 elections, this Goldwater rule was put into place that prevented or that discouraged psychiatrists from diagnosing politicians who they haven't treated personally. And I take it that the organizers at Yale University put on this duty to warn conference as a way to basically say that restriction is no longer applicable and particularly useful in this current context. So fill us in on the history of this book.
Sure. Well, the Goldwater rule was the response to a very small number of psychiatrists who did a foolish thing in the 64 election. That is, they were questioned by a magazine about their thought of Barry Goldwater's fitness to be president. And although the magazine apparently queried everybody, a very small number actually responded. And some of those who responded, perhaps in a lighthearted way, but perhaps not, diagnosed Mr. Goldwater with a variety of problems. And that was inappropriate, no question. But the reason it's not applicable now, there are several reasons, actually. One reason is that the kind of diagnosis that the American Psychiatric Association was referring to when they invented the Goldwater rule in the 70s, that kind of diagnosis, it's true, you cannot make from afar. But that's the diagnosis that has to do with people's inner thoughts, inner conflicts, the kinds of things that are deeply important to them from their personal, individual lives. You need to know somebody to know those kinds of things. But you do not need to interview somebody or know somebody personally in order to know whether they have a personality disorder or a character disorder, because by definition, those things are determined by the person's speech and behavior, not by what goes on inside his head. So those two things are entirely different. And everybody who is now commenting accurately on Donald Trump's character disorder is doing so on the basis of the way they should, on the basis of his very well-known actions and speech over decades. So it's perfectly appropriate to make that diagnosis. Even the American Psychiatric Association's manual for diagnoses works that way. You look at a person's speech and behavior. It's not based on any individual inner life. So there's that. And the second kind of reason why the Goldwater rule is inapplicable now is because back in the 70s, and indeed when the Constitution was written, no one anticipated a Donald Trump. The Constitution was partly written to avoid a Donald Trump. as constitutional scholars have pointed out. The whole idea of checks and balances and the founding fathers wanted to avoid having somebody who is basically a con man take over and become a tyrant. No one was able to do that until Donald Trump did.
Indeed, that was the reasoning behind the Electoral College, at least according to Alexander Hamilton, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think that was part of it. I'm not a scholar of the Founding Fathers, but I believe that was.
Right. Well, let me just read the chapter in this new book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President. This is your chapter. It's titled Sociopathy. Crazy like a fox or just crazy? This question has surrounded Donald Trump since his campaign for president. The question is whether a person who is repetitively immoral, who cons others, lies, cheats, and manipulates to get what he wants, doesn't care whom he hurts just as long as he's gratifying himself, whether such a person's indifference to the feelings of others or personal gain is just being clever, crazy like a fox. Or are these actions a sign of something much more serious? Could they be expressions of significant mental derangement? The answer to that question is emphatically yes. So elaborate on the yes.
Well, the rest of that chapter elaborates on it, but sure.
Good.
The idea that a con man is just okay or just being clever mistakes two different kinds of people. There are people who are, let's say, not con men, but salesmen. And there's nothing wrong with them. They want to sell their product, but presumably they're reasonably honest and they are able to, in their personal lives, be honest with the people around them. That is not the kind of thing we're talking about. We're talking about a fundamental deficiency in understanding the nature of other human beings and caring about them. That's very different. So sociopathy, which is the title of my chapter, pertains to that kind of defect. It's a kind of absence, it's an absence of a kind of humanity, of a piece of humanity. People like this lack empathy. And empathy is not just a nice thing to have. It's an essential part of being a human being. It means you tune into other people, you tune into their feelings, you are able to assess them and care about them. You don't hurt them for no reason. And if you do hurt them, you want to make it up. You feel guilty or you want to do something to correct it. People with this kind of profound defect don't feel that way. They don't care. They hurt people and there is no empathy for them. Empathy is an essential part of humanity, and it's lacking in people with severe sociopathy as it is in Donald Trump. Now, another piece of this, and this all bears on the original question, is he crazy like a fuck? No, he's just This is a deep disturbance. But it has other pieces to it. The incapacity in people like Donald Trump is not only the lack of empathy and the result of it, that there are no real relationships, but there is an inability to accept that there are problems in oneself. So you project them to other people. You say, I'm not the person who's trying to hurt you. You're the problem. You're trying to hurt me. When people project like that, it's called paranoia. And Donald Trump is certainly paranoid. He, as he's shown many, many, many times, he says people are after him. He attacks the media by saying it's making up false facts. And in doing so, what he does is he creates a false reality, which unfortunately he believes.
And so do 35% of the American people, apparently.
I think, well, let's get to the American people in a second.
Okay.
But he believes it, and so he is truly delusional. He is out of touch with reality, at least at those moments. And this has been a hard point to grasp for people because they say, well, you're either crazy or you're not. It's not quite that simple. When he is stressed, he is out of touch with reality in the ways that he has been. He says, I had the largest inauguration crowd in history. It's simply not true. Now, if he were being crazy like a fox, the smartest thing for him to do would be to say, I'm sorry, I misspoke. End of discussion. But he doubles down. He says, oh, yes, I'm right. You're trying to lie. He's actually not doing things in his interest because he can't. He lost track of reality, as he has done repeatedly. So this is, when you combine a lack of empathy, a lack of ability to understand what other people are feeling and to care about the results of what you do to them, with a loss of reality, you have someone extremely dangerous, And he would be dangerous if he were simply a man on the street trying to con people and cheat them out of their savings and lie to them and create fraudulent businesses like Trump University. That would be bad enough. But in the hands, if you give that person the keys to the nuclear codes, then you're facing catastrophe.
And the fact that the Secretary of State apparently in a high-level meeting in the Pentagon tank, the secure room at the Pentagon, in front of a number of senior officials, referred to Trump as a effing moron, would that be his way of saying that there's something wrong with this man?
Yes, I think so. And my guess is that because another characteristic of Donald Trump's condition is that he expects complete loyalty. He needs complete loyalty. He needs you to be praising him and admiring him at all times. That's a part of the narcissism of this condition. But he has no loyalty because he projects. If you're on his side, he will treat you wonderfully. But he can change in a moment and then tell you you're the bad guy, as he has done repeatedly. So Mr. Tillerson and those around him, I'm sure, if no matter what positive feelings they had for him to begin with, after you're with him a little bit, I think you find that this is a man who cannot be trusted and who, in fact, is a moron, not necessarily in the intellectual sense, but he's a moron when it comes to thinking about things because he's unable to think them through in a realistic way.
The problem, of course, here is that you've got this narcissist, but he's landed the greatest role in history in his own reality TV show. He has captured the global stage. This is extraordinary. He can't do any better than that. He's not going to give that up, is he?
No, I think that he would never say this. But one of the part of the catastrophe is that if he could, and I don't think he will be able to, but if he could, I'm sure he would become a tyrant. I'm sure he would eliminate democracy. People like him don't love or care for democracy because democracy itself requires give and take, paying attention to other people's feelings, having a fair vote. He cares nothing for that. It's all about him and his need for power, control, and admiration. So he is a vast danger to do that. So when you say, is there anything better? That would be the better. He would be like the people he admires, like Mussolini.
Putin.
Vladimir
Putin.
And Putin, yes. Mm-hmm. So he would become a dictator if he could. I think our government is stronger than, let's say, the Weimar Republic was in 1932 when Hitler took over with a similar idea. I think we'll be able to survive that. Whether we can survive a nuclear war is another matter, which is another thing he's very likely to get us into because of his paranoia.
And there is no impediment between him and the nuclear button. The system is set up in such a way that the president has the authority to order a nuclear attack. And, you know, the chain of command comes through on an early warning basis. It goes to the Secretary of Defense and then on to the president. But he can actually, if he wakes up on the wrong side of the bed, he can actually order a nuclear attack.
Well, I understand that's the way the system works. We have to hope and pray that, in fact, there are people around him who would prevent that.
Well, that, of course, leads us to the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Republican Senator Bob Corker, who on Wednesday suggested that Generals John Kelly and Mattis and Secretary of State Tillerson are, quote, the people that help separate our country from chaos. And when asked by a reporter, did he mean the President Trump is the source of this chaos? Senator Corker said that Mattis, Kelly, and Tillerson work very well together to make sure the policies we put forth around the world are sound and coherent. There are many other people within this administration that don't. I hope they stay because they're valuable to the national security of our nation. Now, in all of this sort of ephemeral nature of our news coverage and the fact that Donald Trump is like a constant train wreck as far as the media is concerned, they gave him $5 billion worth of free advertising simply because his antics were so extraordinary. This, I think, the gravity of what Senator Corker just said yesterday, I think is being lost to some extent. This is really extraordinarily unusual. The chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who's a Republican, to basically be warning the American people that there's a very, very thin line of Praetorian Guard protecting America from absolute chaos. And the chaos is coming from the President of the United States himself.
Absolutely. And I hope they stay in their jobs also. I don't know anything about our Vice President, but I hope that he can be a moderating influence, although he could be worse. I think he's not. I think whatever else one thinks of his policies, I don't think he has the severe mental deficiencies of Donald Trump. But I would like to touch on you made the point that Senator Corker is a Republican. So to me, this touches on the issue you raised before about the American people, the 33 million American people, because I think we need to separate Donald Trump, the individual, the very sick individual he is, from the people who support him.
Or who voted for him.
Or who voted for him, yes.
Right.
Because I think it would be incorrect to say that there are 33 million people as uncaring and as crazy as Donald Trump. They're not. But con artists, people who are good at manipulating people, are simply better at that than most of us, nearly all of us. That's how they can get to be successful. So he has spent his entire life doing this. This is his life, is to manage other people in a kind of, inhuman way. But he's extremely good at it. So the fact that he was able to fool all those people into thinking that what he said was true, he's going to make America great again, he's going to drain the swamp, all of this was really just a way of his saying, I'm going to make even greater. That's really what it was about. But that doesn't make them evil. And I think that had either the Republicans during the primaries or the Democrats during the election been better, done a better job, then I think more people would have understood that this was not someone they wanted to represent them. So likewise, that goes for Republicans. To say that Republicans are in general like Donald Trump, I think, is untrue. I think that there are plenty of decent Republicans, but no matter what you think of their individual policies, who despise Donald Trump, think he's a terrible representative of their party, and they're terrified.
So what can be done then to reach out to the people, even the core supporters that support him? And one of the problems is that they're living in a media bubble created by Fox News, Sinclair, Breitbart, and Rush Limbaugh and the other talk radio clones of Limbaugh's. And they are in an alternative universe. And he has convinced them that he tells the truth and the rest of the media is purveyors of fake news. In fact, he called upon the Senate Intelligence Committee to investigate fake news, when in fact we know that there's real fake news coming from Russia. But he's basically saying the inquiry into him is fake news. So he's very clever in, as you pointed out earlier, in effect, the pot calling the kettle black, right?
Absolutely. And he also is very well aware of an old technique, but still one that works, which is to say that other people are doing exactly what you are doing. It makes it seem that you couldn't possibly be doing it. Recently, he complained that something was fascism, which to those of us who find his behavior to be fascistic was horrible. But you're right. The media bubble is a problem. It's probably always been a problem, but it's a worse problem now with the nature of the internet and media in this country. Some of us had the idealized sense that the internet would help bring everyone together, which was foolish, I guess, in retrospect, because people just listen to the things that they want and they hear even more of it, and they're influenced. However, I do have perhaps naive hope, but I do still have the hope that the American people are not that foolish or that evil. So that, I mean, there will always be bigots. There will always be people who actually are like Donald Trump. There will be people who say, of course, we see that your objection to the protest of NFL players is really a racist statement, which of course it is. I think people who are not racist are supporting him, but I think eventually he will do badly enough that it will get through to them. So I have some faith in the American people. We'll see.
Well, but let me ask you a question for a psychiatrist, and that is, what psychiatric approach could you make to the people who have voted for him? Some we know just were disgusted with the political system, with politics in Washington, and then every reason to be disgusted with Washington. Some couldn't stand Hillary Clinton, and others really bought Trump's draining the swamp and making America great again. isn't there a problem here that people have a natural tendency to, if you buy a lemon, you want to keep spending more money on the lemon than admit that you've been taken in? So how do you get around that mental defense?
I think that there are two things that went into Donald Trump, at least two major psychological things that went into the people voting for Donald Trump other than what we've already talked about. One of them is that there are a lot of people, perfectly normal people, who desire a strong leader. And the details of that leader may not be so important to them. And this has been true throughout human history. I mean, they want to have a powerful king, a powerful emperor, somebody who will stand up for them and will protect them. It's a kind of a parental ideal. So although most of us wouldn't want to have Donald Trump as a parent, there is that piece of it. Give me somebody strong in these times of trouble. Doesn't matter what else is true. The other piece of it is that because Donald Trump is so unhinged, because he does things that no one else thinks are appropriate, and he doesn't seem to listen to anybody, even good advice from his advisors, there's a certain freedom in that. Now, most of us think that that's on the level of a two-year-old tantrum freedom, but there is a certain freedom of that, and people like that. He's sort of a hero in that way. Here's a guy who can do whatever he wants. That's everyone's fantasy, at least when they were little.
Right, he's a billionaire, too.
And he's a billionaire, and we'll overlook the fact that he went bankrupt several times, and he has bankrupted other people because of his impulsivity and his
selfishness.
Unethicalness. Yeah, right.
Right. Well, fascinating. We should continue this discussion another time. I thank you very much for joining us here today in the studio, Dr. Lance.
It's my pleasure.
And again, Dr. Lance Dodis is a training and supervising analyst emeritus with the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute. And Dr. Dodis is a contributor, along with 26 other psychiatrists and mental health experts who have contributed to the new book, Assessing President Trump, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into signals by the Republican Congress and the NRA that they want to head off any serious moves on gun control by banning so-called bump stocks.
Come on now, who do you think you are? Bless your soul. You really think you're in control?
Kids with guns, taken over by one belong. They mesmerize skeletons. Kids with guns, easy does it.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Saul Cornell, the Paul and Diane Gunter Chair in American History at Fordham University and the author of A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America, Whose Right to Bear Arms Did the Second Amendment Protect? And his latest book is The Second Amendment Goes to Court. Welcome to Background Briefing, Saul Cornell.
Thank you for having me.
And Saul, it looks as though both the Republican Congress and the NRA are trying to head off any serious moves of calls for gun control following the worst mass shooting in U.S. history by banning the so-called bump stocks on these semi-automatic rifles, allowing the weapon to fire bullets at the same at a rate similar to a fully automatic machine gun, which is what, of course, allowed this shooter in Las Vegas to kill so many people so quickly on Sunday night. Do you see it that way?
Well, I think it's a very modest concession from the gun rights lobby and from the NRA. I mean, we've heard from several people that essentially this person was able to circumvent the prohibition on fully automatic weapons by using a very relatively cheap aftermarket add-on to convert his weapon into something that could fire at a rate that much more closely approximates that of an automatic weapon. So they're basically saying, you know, we've already lost on machine guns, so we're not losing that much by conceding this. And yes, I think it is part of an effort, somewhat cynical, to derail a more comprehensive conversation. I mean, of course, the logic of what they've done, once they can sort of concede this point, it seems hard to see how they would argue against the need to act similarly against, for instance, high-capacity magazines. What is the what would be the logical difference? Because they're now conceding that it's the capacity to wreak this kind of havoc that we need to legislate against, and of course there are many other weapons and weapons add-ons that facilitate that kind of killing capacity.
So is there any likelihood of a tipping point here? Because to my mind, this has gotten so insane, and I know that Justice Scalia, who was a gun nut, was able to get through the Heller decision, overturn the whole thrust of the Second Amendment, which simply says that a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state, the citizens' rights to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So the predicate was always clear about a well-regulated. Well, there's nothing regulated about the NRA. They're against regulations. And being necessary for the security of a free state, well, we are no longer secure as Americans in the streets of our own country because of people like this shooter and their access to buying arsenals of weapons and ammunition. So this is where I think the whole thing's been turned on its head. I know it'd be next to impossible to overturn a Supreme Court ruling, but will there be a point in the kind of zeitgeist of this country for people to recognize that the NRA's fundamentalist sort of insistence on unlimited gun rights for a minority of American citizens trumps the majority of us having the freedom and security to be able to walk the streets of America without being afraid of being shot down by some nutcase with an arsenal?
Well, I mean, I think there's no question that we have seen, as a result of Las Vegas, some additional movement on this front. You had people who were strong gun rights advocates who were at the concert sort of recognized the fact that they had a concealed carry permit and may have even had firearms, which some of the people, musicians, had, really wouldn't have done them very much good, in fact did them no good. And we're also, I think, seeing other signs that people are starting to recognize that we need to have a very different conversation, one that's much more calm, deliberate, and thoughtful. But, you know, we do have some structural problems. I mean, we have, you know, very interesting to see what happens when the Supreme Court deals with gerrymandering, because one of the reasons it's so hard to get any kind of legislation at the national level is we have this system where gerrymanders make it very difficult for the people to be truly represented in Congress. So it's hard to say which way this is going to go. This is certainly more movement than we've had in a while, and you know, it's a cause for some hope. I don't know whether we're yet at the tipping point.
Well, but you have to ask yourself, when is enough enough? I mean, obviously, a lot of people, including President Obama, thought that the massacre at Sandy Hook, near where you live in Connecticut, would have been a tipping point, but it wasn't. This one is now being billed incessantly on television as the worst mass shooting in modern United States history. So what more does it take?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, one of the interesting things about the post-Sandy Hook world is that actually at the local level, we've seen this remarkable drift apart, where in parts of the country where gun regulation was always strong, things got stronger, and in parts of the country where gun regulation was always weak, they got weaker. So, you know, we really are two different nations when it comes to this issue. What's sort of amazing is this happened in red America to people who are generally very red in their politics at this country western concert, and they have been touched in a way that perhaps they've not been touched directly before. So some inroads will definitely be made within that community. But again, you know, Congress was about to deal with silencer suppressors. They've been trying to eradicate local gun regulations by passing some kind of concealed carry reciprocity law. The optics on that are probably not very good for a while. They'll probably put that on the back shelf, but it'll be interesting to see whether or not they push forward. I mean, we've seen now several mass shootings, including the one that happened to Republican Congress people, and they're still interested in pushing for concealed carry reciprocity. I mean, Scalise came back and said his own horrible experience as a victim of gun violence hasn't changed his mind about anything. It's kind of hard to fathom how someone could really have that point of view. I read some interviews today with some Republican members of Congress who were saying really just the most bizarre things. It was, I think, on Vox, and one of them said, well, in the Old West, you know, the idea that you could be shot was one reason why people didn't get shot, which is straight out of Hollywood and has nothing to do with the reality of the way things functioned in the West. So, until Congress starts learning its history from books instead of from Westerns, it's hard to know how much progress we're going to make with people like that.
Well, but this concealed carry reciprocity means that progressive states like California have their rights and regulations and laws get trumped by permissive states like Las Vegas and Alabama and other states who have unlimited unregulation.
Well, of course, and it's ironic that conservatives, including many of these Republicans for years, have been screaming about the overbearing nature of the federal government and the importance of federalism and states' rights. But, of course, when it comes to guns, none of these traditional conservative positions matter very much. I mean, it's the worst kind of hypocrisy. But my one hope is that even if they try to pass such a law, it's so clearly a violation of federalism that if the Supreme Court has even an iota left of intellectual integrity, they would strike that kind of thing down. But I've been wrong before about the integrity of the courts.
But just in closing, it's pretty extraordinary that just because Scalia himself was such an avid gun collector and aficionado and shooter that he imposed his personal preferences on the entire country and its history in the same way that the NRA, which only has 5 million members, is able to impose its extreme minority agenda on the rest of us and expose us all to such danger.
Well, there's no question that there's been a lot of criticism of Scalia's decision in Heller, and what's interesting is some of the worst criticism comes from conservative judges like Judge Posner and Judge Wilkinson and Charles Freed, the former Solicitor General under it was either Nixon or Reagan. But yeah, I mean, there's no question that that the Heller decision was quite remarkable, but there are things in Heller that bode well for the future of gun regulation. We just have to hope that people like Judge Gorsuch are persuadable that when the history actually cuts against them, that they have to remain consistent.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Saul Cornell.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
And again, I'm speaking with Saul Cornell, who is the Paul and Diane Gunter Chair in American History at Fordham University and author of A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America, Whose Right to Bear Arms Did the Second Amendment Protect? And his latest book is The Second Amendment Goes to Court. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.